While central banks generally rely on official statistics to tell them what's going on in the economy, the speed and granularity of private data is becoming increasingly appealing to policymakers.
So the one place that a lot of the non-traditional statistics really struggle is being representative. Like, they're going to give us a great picture of whatever company, you know, created these data by just doing their regular business, but it probably isn't going to tell us about the economy as a whole. So I'm Claudia Somm. I'm the chief economist at New Century Advisors and a former Federal Reserve economist.
Claudia Somm has studied the expanding role of alternative data in financial institutions. Her recent article, Alternative Data and Monetary Policy, is published in the December issue of Finance and Development magazine. So what are the traditional sources of data that central banks or the Fed normally use to inform their policy decisions?
When we think about traditional data sources, there's a few things that come to mind. The first and foremost would be the statistics that we get out of government agencies. And these are ones like the national accounts, so GDP, income, inflation. And so these are measures that, not just in the United States, but around the world, there are standards in how they're collected, and it's done on a regular basis, and they're published officially. So those are definitely what we consider traditional statistics. There's also been a longstanding set of economic indicators that come out of the private sector, but they're often also surveys, right? So they have kind of a statistical method behind them. You know, these companies or sometimes universities, they go out with the intention to create a statistic about the economy. And so that has a lot to do with their method. And so we've had, I mean, a wide array of traditional statistics about the economy, a lot of them based on surveys, not all of them, but most of them based on surveys. And this is something that's really been a part of kind of the data ecosystem, you know, since the post-World War II period. We've had these kind of data.
I'm just curious, are these agencies like commissioned, like for the BLS, for example, is this an agency that's commissioned by the Fed to collect that data? Or, you know, we talk a lot about central bank independence. Are these agencies also independent?
So much of the federal statistics, I mean, these are funded by Congress. So really, you know, the principal indicators, Congress is setting priorities, has the funding sources. So the Bureau of Economic Analysis that does GDP, the Bureau of Labor Statistics does unemployment and inflation, like those are funded, have their budgets approved by Congress. Like, that's really where the oversight is for most of the federal government statistics. The Federal Reserve itself produces some statistics. So industrial production is one of our longest running economic statistics, and that is housed at the Fed, and they run the Survey of Consumer Finances and some other household and bank surveys. So the Fed itself does some creation of statistics, but largely think of them as flowing out of Congress.
Okay. So what's missing in this data? I mean, why are central bankers increasingly interested in alternative sources for data, as you suggest they are?
Right. So central bankers are one of many audiences for these for additional statistics. I think something that's very important in monetary policy is having a timely read on the economy. And the United States, really, for our traditional statistics, our government statistics come out relatively quickly, but there's a lag. Even some of our quickest turn indicators, like the unemployment rate, they're measured for the middle of the month and they come out at the beginning of the next month. Right. Like, that's really a pretty quick turnaround, but it's still weeks. And there are other statistics where the delays can be more like months. And so, especially if the economy is going through a change, like going into a recession, starting a recovery, like times where, you know, economic policymakers would need to be reacting quickly, time is of the essence. And so the faster you can have data, the you know, there are definitely benefits to that. So speed is one aspect of it. And some of the non-traditional data, the ones that are kind of kicked off from just, you know, private companies doing their everyday, you know, transactions of credit cards or payroll processing. So some of those can turn around very quickly in terms of getting a read on the economy. So there's the speed aspect of it. The other piece that's important for a lot of stakeholders is the private sector data. Some of it can be much more granular. Like if you had some detailed aspect of the economy, particularly if it's a new detailed aspect of the economy, it can be really helpful to drill down with the private sector data, whereas it would be really onerous to make the government surveys large enough to get, like, say, geographic detail, to get really redesign surveys quickly to get some new feature of the economy. There was a lot of this, you know, say in the pandemic, where, you know, some features happened really rapidly changing the economy. So the government statistics, the traditional statistics move along with it, but it just becomes cost prohibitive to try to fill in all the gaps. And so you have other data sources that can add to that.
So like when you say things like payroll processing and credit card transactions, how much access does the Fed have to that kind of thing? I mean, do they just call up J.P. Morgan or whatever company it might be and ask for that data? Like, do they need to purchase it, or how do they access it?
Right. So it's, you know, you can certainly try to call up and ask for the data, but but the reality is, I mean, for private companies, the data that they create, even if it's just data created out of doing business, it's really central to their organization, and they want to be really careful about who has that information, right? Because it could be, you know, market moving for that company. So I think one of the things, and I saw this as an economist at the Fed, and you know, we really started doing a lot of big data projects in 2015, 2016. And like my understanding of this has really evolved over time, how the private companies think about their data. It's like we're trying to navigate and create arrangements and contracts. Some of them, you know, as a paying customer, I mean, the Fed's a paying customer on a lot of data contracts, just like anybody else who'd want data. But then also there are sometimes special arrangements and agreements about data sharing, because often, you know, at the Fed, again, you know, there are a lot of people there that are creating statistics. They have a lot of knowledge in how you could take private sector data and turn it into an economic statistic, which is a project that I worked on with credit card transactions and like retail sales estimates. So there can be these cooperations, but what's really tricky is, you know, we need data that we can rely on, like every month, every week, whatever the situation is. And because these new contracts and agreements and it's pretty new, and sometimes they can be a little fragile. You know, because I like to say, you know, private companies are not in the business of creating public goods.
Right.
Data, economic statistics, at the end of the day, they are public goods. We want them to be easily accessible. People can, you know how they're put together. And a private company, I mean, they've got to serve their paying clients first and foremost. So there have been plenty of private companies that have created statistics, have been out there, whether they're, you know, selling it or sharing it. But at the end of the day, it's just not, to me, it's just not as reliable as government agencies that are funded by Congress and have a mandate that's very clear. Now, those can change too, but it's just we're still a little bit in the wild, wild west of creating data, which can be really exciting, what comes online, new information. But then there are some heartbreaks along the way, because data you've been using that are really helpful, they disappear. Because it's just no longer useful, that collaboration.
Yeah, there's private companies have different motivations for collecting various sorts of data. So, you know, I assume data from agencies like the BLS have gone through this rigorous cleaning process by the time the Fed sees it. So to what extent can we assume that these non-traditional or alternative sources of data are accurate? Does the Fed have a process to sort of verify any of this data that they're using from private companies?
So absolutely. I mean, it's going to be dependent on the situation. It's not like there's a, you know, an approach that applies to all data. But you're looking, and this is also, the Fed has done several big data projects in-house where they're getting the credit card transactions or they're getting the payroll processing transactions. And a first step is, you know, can we get changes, dynamics that like look like the government statistics that we trust? Because again, a lot of times you're wanting the private data, it's more timely, it's more granular. Well, you can start with, if we kind of line up, do they look similar? I mean, you wouldn't expect them to be exactly the same, right? Because when we go out and collect data, there's always going to be some noise and measurement and some issues. But if they're telling wildly different stories and you can't explain it from like fundamentals, like, oh, this is just a very different sample of households or these businesses are different. Like you have to be able to make sense of the data where we kind of quote unquote trust the government statistics more. And then once you, you know, you have some trust in these private sector, these alternate data, then you can start to explore the timelier pieces of it, the more granular pieces of it. But it really is, I mean, it takes time to build that case that the data are worth paying attention to. You know, so that's that scrutiny is happening even with government, even with the traditional statistics, because they can degrade over time too. So there is a high degree of skepticism about the data. And then of course, you're always looking at as many different metrics and measures of the same phenomenon. And seeing if kind of, you know, where do they overlap? Like that's usually where the truth is. If you've got some weird outliers, they're probably just that, weird outliers that you can ignore. But it's a really time-consuming process, and it takes a lot of skill to be able to filter all of these new types of data that are out there.
And building on that, in the article, you talk about how these alternative sources of data are especially helpful in scenarios, and you touched upon this a little earlier, where things are changing very quickly, like, for example, today's trade environment. How does this type of data fit into that in terms of policymaking?
So we are still at a place where the non-traditional data are complementing, augmenting what we have from the kind of traditional statistics. Much of the discussion about what is the effect of tariffs on inflation in the United States, it's still focusing largely on the CPI or other government inflation statistics. Like that's still where we're centering kind of the estimates and the methodology for these, you know, quote unquote tariff pass-throughs. And yet, the data that we have on inflation doesn't have detail on like country of origin. Like we can't really carefully map through a tariff rate onto a good, onto like its whole way to getting to be a price tag that we, you know, end up paying at the consumer prices. So when we do studies with the official statistics or with the traditional data, there's lots of assumptions and kind of mapping and piecing together different parts of data. Whereas there's some really interesting work that's been done with online pricing data that has the ability where we can get much more granular of like exactly what country that item came from, match that up with a tariff level, look other competitor products. And so you can really look with more detail at that process of how tariffs might be affecting the prices that are paid by consumers in a way that you just can't, we don't have that degree of precision in the official statistics. So it kind of helps test hypotheses, really unpack with more detail. Because in the official data, there's enough slippage that it's like, yeah, it's probably tariffs, but it might not be, like it could be something else. Whereas the more granular data, you can have a much finer ability to kind of test the hypotheses, but it's the story, like what's happening with tariff pass-through and is it done? Is it, you know, how far do we have left to go? And that's where these granular data, the non-traditional data, they expand what we know, but it's still more of a adding and augmenting as opposed to we're going to use those to make our official estimates of what's happening.
Right. So again, you mentioned this a little earlier, but I'm curious about it. Working as an economist at the Fed at the time, you're involved in this interesting project that ultimately helped determine some real economic impacts of hurricanes in the southern U.S. Tell us more about that.
Right. So I was part of a team of economists who, and also some data engineers who had created retail sales series that were daily and had, you know, at the state level, you know, geographically specific. Whereas the retail sales series from Census Bureau are monthly and at a national level. So we had built these spending indicators and were able to, like during a hurricane, so during Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, which just happened to be right around a Federal Open Market Committee meeting. So as the Fed was meeting, thinking about their interest rate decisions, we were able to give, like with a day or two of a lag, updates on what we were estimating as the hurricane effects on retail spending and like certain categories. Now, it's often the case that, you know, weather is something that often disrupts economic activity in the short term, a hurricane or a winter storm. So this is nothing new, right? This has happened. Mm-hmm. But typically we would be estimating from data, what are the historical patterns? What does it usually look like in these weather events? Whereas what we were able to do with these alternative data was not estimate or we're tracking it. Mm-hmm. We're being able to, from the data itself, so you can take into account, you know, special features of the hurricanes. Like, we're just looking at the data as it comes in. And, you know, I don't want to say that the data didn't, you know, upend the thinking of the FOMC, because it very much it aligned with how we often think about weather effects. But they were given very detailed information in almost real time about what was happening in the economy. And I do think, again, that's one where it augments and it gives more support. I mean, it was really pretty striking to be watching that in real time, being able to give that to policymakers.
So finally, I mean, as useful as this big data or, you know, the data collected by private companies is proving to be, the data itself is only really as good as it is because of the level of public participation. And people generally are paying a lot closer attention now to data collection practices by these companies, which is making it, I think, a little more difficult for them. Can you see a day where, like, cookie policies, for example, might undermine the real value of this data for policymakers?
So it's certainly something that I worry about. In our traditional statistics, which many of which are based on surveys, a real challenge has been that over time, people and businesses are much less willing to participate in the surveys. And there's a whole host of reasons, but that really has been a big issue for a lot of the traditional statistics, and in some ways makes these alternative data that just, you know, get created really appealing. But I mean, the reality is those are the data that are, you know, created when we purchase something or, you know, a payroll is run through a business. If we're transparent, I think there's certainly an argument for that transparency about, you know, we're kind of giving our data, we're selling our data when we're buying things. You know, we just see the sales price netted out at the end. Mm-hmm. But the more awareness you have about that, there's a potential that you can, like, that people might find a way to conceal those data. And we certainly saw it in the retail sales project we were doing with the card transaction group. There were businesses that told the primary company, we don't want our data used for anything.
Right.
Research purpose. Like, they weren't allowed, you know, the company couldn't use it. We couldn't have it. So because again, data are very valuable. And sometimes we're, you know, quote unquote, giving it away for free. Like, we don't even realize we're doing it. But I mean, eventually the world will catch on, and that it could be a potential. So I am very much for more transparency in how these data are being collected. And I think there's also a need just to the institutional framework, the cooperation, that really like align incentives of the private companies sharing the data for the economic statistics. big surveys are very costly, and people don't want to be burdened with answering surveys. And this probably is the path forward. But I think there's kind of at a fundamental level of like the sharing agreements, the trust arrangements, and the pricing. Like, these things really do need to get figured out, because they're not trivial issues.
So great potential, but there's also a lot to think about in terms of the way that this data is collected. Claudia Sam is the chief economist at New Century Advisors and a former principal economist at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can read Claudia Sam's article on alternative data and monetary policy in the December issue of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND. And you'll find lots more IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.